To all who come to this happy place, welcome.
Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, welcome once again to the official Disneyland Resort podcast, a unique look at the magical moments and events here at the place where dreams come true. Join us each month as we celebrate the Year of a Million Dreams with a behind-the-scenes look at what's new and exciting here at the Disneyland Resort. And now, here is your host, Michael Gohagan.
Are you ready to come along for a ride? In this edition of the Disneyland Resort Podcast, we'll transport you into the past and then take you behind the scenes to experience some of the present and future fun that are part of the Year of a Million Dreams. First, we'll climb on board the Disneyland Railroad for an historical look at one of the most popular attractions at Disneyland Park. Then, it's over to Disney's California Adventure for a sneak peek at the all-new and energetic Pixar Play Parade. When you think of transportation today, we have lots of options. Monorails, automobiles, segways, and even rocket jets. But at the turn of the 20th century, trains were a popular and essential part of getting around. And no one loved trains more than Walt Disney. His fascination began as a young boy when he learned about life on the railroad from his uncle Michael, who was a steam locomotive engineer. And as a teen, Walt took a job selling candy and newspapers on the Santa Fe Railway. And after becoming a successful filmmaker, he built his own backyard track and named it the Carrollwood Pacific Railroad. And it was that miniature railroad which became part of the inspiration for Disneyland Park. Today, the Disneyland Railroad is one of the most popular and visible attractions at the resort. The fleet of five genuine steam locomotives transports thousands of guests around the Grand Circle Tour every year. We had the opportunity to go behind the scenes and find out what it takes to keep one of America's most famous railways online and on time every day.
Your attention, please. The Disneyland Limited, now leaving for a Grand Circle tour of the Magic Kingdom.
I'm joined now by Vern. And Vern, what is it you do here at the Disneyland Resort?
Hey, I'm a conductor on the resort. I get to play on this train all day long, and it's one of the funnest jobs here in the park.
Well, speaking of that, where are we right now?
Well, right now we've just left the Main Street Station. We're going through the jungles of eastern Java, I think, and we are traveling right along the steel rails of the Disneyland Railroad on our way to Main Street eventually. But first, we're going to be going through New Orleans Square, Toontown, and Tomorrowland. And once again, we'll be returning to Main Street, USA.
Sounds like a spiel you've had down for a while.
Oh, I tell you, after a while, you get to the point where you even know where the cues are on the tapes. Really a lot of fun. We're now entering into New Orleans Square, going through the tunnel on our way into our queue area where the guests get to load on board this beautiful train.
Well, now, speaking of that, we're in a special car, I guess you would call this, correct?
Yes, this is. This is the Lilybell. This is the last remnant of our number one train, the Retlaw 1 train. It was the first train here in the park that came in to the station when Walt Disney gave his dedication speech back in July 17, 1955. The car has been here in the park basically ever since. The car originally was called the Grand Canyon. It was the observation car, the last car on the train. The number is even respected today. It's car number 106. We no longer have a number one train. It's since gone on. It was purchased by a collector when it became surplus here at the park. And it's up in San Luis Obispo for the cars anyway. And this particular one we have converted originally as the Bicentennial car back in 1976. And then it was recently was sent back out, outshopped, and became what it is today. The Lilybell is a very gorgeous example of Victorian railroading.
And this car has a special pass in the sense it was used for special events or special visitors, guests here at the park. Is that right?
That's correct. The first actual VIPs that were on the car back in 1976 was Emperor Hirohito and his wife from Japan, and they were the first ones on here. But we've had many, many potentates and kings and other VIPs on this car.
Now, one of the things about trains here at Disneyland is, I know even with my own children, I mean, it's when you enter the park, I mean, it's the first thing that kind of greets the guest here. But with your experience, what do you find is the guest reaction to these trains? Why do you think it's so tactile in the sense that everybody seems to have an attraction to it?
Well, I think it's the first thing that they see when they enter into the park, this huge station right behind the ticket booths where they get to come in. They see the trains pull in with the whistle blowing and the bell ringing. And that brings to our older adults some of the romance of the railroading that they used to enjoy. And to our younger ones, that bell and that whistle really attract them. They want to see, how does that thing work? And that's why they come here. The cars hold an awful lot of people that we get to travel around and enjoy and show them our beautiful park.
Well, now, speaking of the trains, we were chatting a little bit earlier, and you were telling me a little bit about kind of the size of the train and its scale. What can you tell us about that?
Well, the original two trains, number Retlaw 1 and Retlaw 2, were 5/8 scale, which they still are. This car is 5/8 scale, except for one thing. The doors are 6 feet tall so that we can have full-size people come through it, not 5/8 scale. We are also traveling on a narrow gauge track, that is, it's 3 feet. Now, in the United States, we normally have 4 feet, 8.5 inches. So, but this is, again, it's a 3-foot narrow gauge rail, which you would normally see in the Rocky Mountains, areas like that where they would use it. Gauge has always been a area where people have differed over the years, but finally, during the Civil War especially, we began to convert everything to a standard gauge so all of our trains could be interchangeable.
Well, now, these trains also had a special place in Walt's heart.
Walt really loved it. You know, from his early childhood, he always saw the trains. And one of his first jobs was working on the railroad. He was a news butcher. He provided all kinds of different things to people, apples and newspapers and magazines. He grew up with the particular railroading in mind. When he got a little bit older, he began to work, of course, in the animation. He'd come to Hollywood. He came to Hollywood on the train, and he really enjoyed that ride. When he got here, he got heavier in animation, kind of stepped away a little bit from the trains, but he made a mistake. That is, he hired a couple of guys that really enjoyed railroading. Ollie Johnson was one. Ward Kimball was one. Walt really enjoyed the trains, and when he saw what Ollie had and what Ward had, why, of course, he wanted to have something, too. So he built one in his backyard. He actually had to go into a lawyer's office with his wife, Lillian, in order to get permission to build it. Kind of unheard of, but he needed to get his right-of-way down because Lillian did not want him in her flower beds. She was emphatic about that. She made sure that Walt was able to get the rails down and enjoy his hobby while she enjoyed hers. Now, he built a special area behind the house. He called it Yesid Valley. That's Disney backwards. And that's where Roger Brogy helped Walt build the locomotives and the cars. Ollie Johnson helped out, and so did Ward. But Walt was very proud of one thing he did for his railroad. He built his own caboose. He wouldn't let anybody else touch it or handle it because it was Walt's caboose. He did the whole thing himself, and he was very, very proud of that. He had his own workshop at home, the barn. The Carol Wood Society has that now. It's over at L.A. at the Live Steamers. He really enjoyed that. But people kept coming over and riding on the trains with him. He was right across the street. He lived there in Holmby Hills, right across from Burt Lancaster. Well, Burt loved the trains, too. And then a friend of Burt's would come over and want to play in the trains. And then a friend of Burt's would come over to play in a train. Pretty soon he had more people there he knew what to do with, which made it a little bit difficult. I really think that's why he wanted to find a place where he could run trains, where he could charge people to come and ride on his trains. And that's where we came with Disneyland.
Well, now, when this train was first set up, you were talking earlier, you referred to Retlaw, I think. And is it true that it was somewhat separate from the park? It obviously was part of it, but Walt kind of kept it a little bit separate in his own way.
Retlaw was actually the company that owned the railroads here at Disneyland. Disneyland did not own the railroads. Some people don't know that. Retlaw Corporation also owned the monorail and the Tiki Room. They were all part of Retlaw. Walt and even signed payroll checks for the people here at the park that operated the trains, because it was his company, after all, Retlaw being Walter backwards.
I wonder if all those people actually cashed those checks. In some cases, you got his signature on them.
Yeah, actually, no, there's some checks that did not get turned in for cashing, that's for sure, because Walt was very private with his autograph. In fact, he very seldom gave an autograph in public. What he'd normally do is the apartment that's located right above the fire station, he would take out a pad of paper, and he would write his name down on it a couple of times, his autograph. And then as he traveled around the park, when he really was besieged by people that wanted his autograph, instead of him signing something that they would present to him, he would take out a piece of paper and hand it to them. And this way, he wasn't signing a program or a ticket or anything like that. He was very, very private about his autograph.
Now, the steam engines, they're all steam engines. And what kind of fuel do these run on?
Well, today they're running on biodiesel. We converted in May of 2005 into biodiesel. Even the Mark Twain today is biodiesel, by the way. But we converted from diesel fuel. We were using about 190,000 gallons of diesel fuel here in the park. And you can see where that's become quite a savings for us, and it's also very ecologically good. Now, we also use 150 gallons of water every hour in our locomotives. Every one of them uses 150 gallons of water. We turn that into steam using that biodiesel.
You and I were chatting a little bit before we got on the car here, and you were kind of making a comment that I thought was really interesting about the engines coming to life.
It's part of the romance, I think, of steam trains. Today, when we see those diesel locomotives sitting around, we can hear them chattering, but nothing's really happening. If you go back in the roundhouse early in the morning when they begin to steam up the locomotives, they put a fire under the boiler and the water begins to boil and you hear the hissing of the steam. The locomotive seems to come alive from being something completely dead and cold. It comes to a very live and living thing. The steam just helps make it. The steam comes from many different places, not just from one, but it just adds some of the more of the mystique and the romance of the railroad.
You know, you think with so many things and technology the way that it is, things are getting much more controlled and quiet. And the trains are one place where you've got, you know, snorts and spurts and steam and things coming out and moving around. And I wonder if that's one of the attractions for a lot of park guests as well.
Oh, I'm sure it is. I mentioned before the whistle and the bell up above them as we go by where they're coming into the park. And they see that, the clanking of the couplers coming together. It's just really just part of the magic of being an entirely different attraction other than any other things that they have in the park, because everything is so electronically controlled and run by a computer and so on. This is perhaps one of the best rides because it is so mechanical that you get involved in the mechanics of how it operates more so than the rest of the show, the lights and the bells and the whistles.
What's your favorite thing about working on the railroad here?
My favorite thing about working on the railroad is the people that come here. I get to greet people from all over the world, and they enjoy the ride, and I enjoy the ride with them. I like to point out the history of the park to them. The railroad is just such a romantic thing. If in the background you've been able to hear us go over different ties and the switches and things like that, it just adds to it. Just makes so much more of an attraction. It's fun for me. I get to ride out in the air because we get to ride outside the car. People get to ride inside the car. And it's just really a wonderful, wonderful thing.
I think it's also, just in hearing you explain that, it also kind of, for me at least, brings to mind the fact that with my son, I remember going on train rides with my father and even with my grandfather. And now with my children, in some ways, it's an experience that kind of ties generations together.
Well, it is. You got to realize that passenger trains have become less and less useful, apparently, in our society. Everybody going to an airplane or something like that. We are just beginning to realize that there are some ways we can use rail to help move people, but it's still, when you have a steam engine and a clickety-clack on the track, just makes it different. Today, we're welding the rails together. We're putting in concrete ties instead of wooden ties. It's just completely changed. It used to be the romance of the conductor yelling all aboard. Even today, we don't see that because everybody uses a radio and they don't have to yell to the engineer anymore like we do here on the train, which I think really adds to it because we're after the experience of the railroading. Actually, as it happened, Walt always wanted to have it to be an educational experience. And this is how it was back in the late 1800s and early 1900s.
Well, you know, as we kind of circle around the park here and start to head back, I just want to thank you for taking the time to sit down and chat with us.
Well, you're more than welcome. I hope you come back again and see us soon. Don't be a stranger, because we'd love to have people come back.
Great. Well, let's enjoy the rest of the ride.
Let's do that.
It takes more than 40 engineers to keep the Disneyland Railroad up and running every day. The steam locomotives need constant attention. Whether it's replacing parts, lighting the engines, or just a quick touch of paint, these trains are some of the best-kept vehicles in the world. I visited the Disneyland Roundhouse to find out what it takes to keep the railroad running. All right, I'm joined now by John. And John, what is it you do here at the Disneyland Resort?
I'm the night lead on the Disneyland steam trains, and I really enjoy my job here.
So you get to work with trains every day then?
Every day steam trains. Steam is special.
Well, tell us, where are we right now?
We're standing right now in front of the roundhouse looking at the front of engine number 3, and it's our 1894 Baldwin, and we'll run tomorrow for the first time in a year.
And you mentioned that. So this train has been offline, I guess you would say, for about a year now. What have you been doing to the train?
Well, it left Disneyland for about 6 of those months and got a new boiler, and they put a new cab on it, new drivers, basically just got it back up to speed after being used and abused for quite a few years.
Well, I think that a lot of people sometimes are kind of surprised that these are real steam engines. But, you know, here today, you know, where do you go to get one of these fixed? I mean, there's not a corner train supply store, and I would assume it's a very specialized process. How do you do that?
Well, some of the parts are actually made here for us in the park. A lot of the parts are documented, and so we have prints on them. We also have access for the bigger parts, like a boiler. We go to get outside bids, and there are several companies that do that kind of work.
And so essentially, with kind of these big moving parts, like you mentioned, in some cases you have plans to go make them, you know, on a lathe or something if you had to.
That's correct. Building 500 supports us well here at the park on bearings and bushings and that sort of thing.
Well, now, what can you tell us about this engine? We were talking a little bit. It runs on steam. And you were mentioning that the pressure has a lot to do with the success of the engine.
That's correct. For the last 45 years or so, the park was running on about 125 pounds steam pressure. But when engine number 5 was brought online for the first time, they went to safeties at 175, so we run at a working pressure of 150 pounds. The expansion of the steam for the same amount of water is more, so you get more for your money.
So with a little more pressure, you're going to get more power for the same amount of water, basically.
That's correct.
Well, let's walk back here.
Sure.
Now, you mentioned the sort of fuel that these run on.
Last year, we changed over to biodiesel. We had been running on regular diesel number 2, and we weren't very confident in the biodiesel, but after the testing was done, we were pleasantly surprised that it works just as well.
Well, and then now, in a case like this, I mean, how much fuel goes into a train like this?
The tender can hold about 250 gallons.
And is that enough to last you for the day?
It could last us for the day, but it's gravity-fed, and we have a refueling station behind the bushes in Toontown. And so on evenings when the park is open until midnight, we will refuel approximately 5 p.m.
Well, now, I noticed in here, I mean, there's no steering wheel. there's a lot of levers and things like that. But one of the things that caught my attention is, I guess you'd call it the speedometer, but it's in feet per second.
That's correct. The way it breaks down is it's 14.66 feet per second for 10 miles per hour.
Okay. Well, now, with a steam engine like this, how many people does it take to operate it?
Well, yeah, we have one fireman and one engineer.
And the fireman tends the fire.
The fireman is responsible for the fire. He is responsible for the water level in the boiler and the steam pressure.
Okay.
We have a water glass, and you can see it's like our window into the boiler, and you can tell how much water is in the boiler by that. We have an injector on each side of the locomotive, one for the fireman and one for the engineer. But the fireman is responsible for the water level, and when he sees it's getting low, he'll turn on the injector.
Right. What's the process at the end of the day when the train's come home for the evening?
Okay, we back the trains in, and we put them about 30 feet further back than they need to be, and we uncouple the steam engine and bring it forward under a blower that can take the fumes away from the stack. Mm-hmm. The reason that we separate them is so that we can do maintenance more easily. We wouldn't have to separate them, but it's just easier for maintenance. And then we fuel it, water it, lubricate it, basically find out if there's any issues with the engines and try to get them corrected before the next day.
And is there like a cool down process that you have to go? I mean, I assume they come in here pretty hot.
They do. There isn't really a cool down process. We try to capture as much of the heat as possible. We have a peephole back here in the back of the boiler that we close to try to keep the heat in. We also put a stack cover on top of the stack so that it also keeps the heat in.
The way that you described how you put the trains away, I mean, it almost sounds like livestock or something, you know, almost like a living creature.
That's true. The engines are very different, almost like they have different personalities. They all engineer different. They fire different. They feel different because of the shock absorbing system in them. Some of them will be having issues and they won't fire as well as they ought to be. It takes a while for a fireman and or an engineer to get used to all of the equipment we have, because we have five engines and four trains.
Working here, I mean, I would assume you know this, but do some of your firemen and engineers, I mean, do you know that they have favorite trains that they're always trying to?
Absolutely. Oh, yeah. As a matter of fact, the one we're standing next to, the Fred Gurley, which is engine 3, used to be a big favorite, and everybody's wondering how she'll be tomorrow when they fire her back up and start using her again.
Well, now, speaking of that, so what's the process in the morning when it's, you know, you're getting ready for the park to open? How do you prepare the trains?
Well, they'll open up the pit and climb underneath the engine and check it out, make sure that everything looks like it's in place. And then they'll take the stack cover off, and if the pressure's too low, they'll hook it up to shop air. Otherwise, if the pressure's high enough, they can fire it off the steam and bring it back up to pressure. And they have a checklist of many things they go through also, to be sure she's ready to go.
Well, now, yeah, that's interesting. You mentioned that you try to keep as much pressure. I mean, is the engine firing all night long, or is it you've shut it down and you've captured the pressure in the boiler, basically?
Yeah, that's correct. We shut it down, and by capping the stack and closing the firebox tightly, we try to keep as much steam pressure as possible. Steam engines are notorious for lots of leaks. Mm-hmm. And depending on how many leaks there are, there may not be enough pressure in the morning to light off. But by adding a stack cover, that helps about 20 pounds in the morning. And if you have at least 20 pounds on the boiler, a good fireman or an operating engineer can light her off and build her back up to the 125 you need to leave.
It's almost like a bicycle I had when I was a kid. You always had to pump up the tire in the morning, but it would make it all day.
Just a little bit. That's right.
Oh, but what is your favorite thing about working with the trains here?
Gosh, it's hard to put a finger on it. I like the people. We have a lot of good people that work here with us. I like the history. I like the fact that we're given the responsibility of taking care of Walt Railroad. And it was quite a great idea that he had. And he had a train in his backyard, and his buddies had large engines, and he wanted large engines too. And I'll be darned if he didn't figure out a way to get them.
Well, thank you so much for taking the time to chat with us today.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
After our journey with the Disneyland Railroad, we headed over to Disney's California Adventure to see what the Pixar gang of characters is up to. It's no surprise that toys like to have fun. We caught up with Woody, Nemo, Buzz Lightyear, The Incredibles, and all their Disney Pixar friends dancing in the streets to the sound of the all-new Pixar Play Parade. This show features colorful new floats, acrobatics, high-energy choreography, and a few other surprises. We went backstage and caught up with the producer, David Miller, and Emmy-nominated director-choreographer, Fred Tollickson, to get the inside scoop on this lively parade. All right, I'm joined now by David. And David, what is it you do here at the Disneyland Resort?
I'm a production manager here at the park, working on a lot of the big entertainment projects.
And we're backstage on a pretty big entertainment project right now.
Yeah, absolutely. We're backstage with all of the floats from the Pixar Play Parade.
All right, and now, and Fred, what is it you do here?
I'm the show director for the parade, and I'm also responsible for a large portion of the choreography, but pretty much overseeing the general overall big picture and making sure it's all working in respect to the creative overview that was that's been kind of worked on for the last 8-9 months.
So you're kind of the creative driving force behind the you know, what's going to happen? What are you going to see? What are the dancers and entertainers going to do? Is that correct?
Yeah, pretty much.
Okay. And now, is this the first time you've worked on a Disney parade? Is that correct?
This is my first Disney parade. Yes, that's correct. The last project that I worked for at Disney is at Tokyo Disney Seas on The Legend of Mythica. I was one of the two choreographers. Uh-huh. So I met a lot of the creative team there. And so they asked me back to work on this. And it's been really amazing.
I understand you also had a kind of a music video background as well. Is that right?
I'm pretty much an eclectic choreographer in the business. So I do film, TV, commercials, music videos, stage, industrials, theme parks. What if they're paying for a choreographer, I'm there.
Well, now, with a parade like this, when you kind of sit down and you get the sense of what you want to convey, what's your process for figuring out how to bring that to life?
Well, you know, I wish it was like that, because then I could take credit for everything, but it's actually a team of a lot of creative people who really sit down together and brainstorm a lot of the ideas. So by the time I was brought in as the show director, the general overall story, the creative direction was already determined. So I'm pretty much hired to make sure that happens the way it's supposed to. So, I mean, I did get a lot of my own ideas into it, but it's a big team effort. There's amazing designers and artists and music and down the line, wardrobe, costumes. Every department has a lot of incredible people, and, you know, we hash it all out and collaborate, so.
Well, now, as a park guest, if I come to view the parade, what should I expect?
First of all, be prepared to get a little bit wet, because the Pixar Play Parade involves a little bit of water and some misting and spraying. But it's super fun, playful, high energy. You're going to see a lot of your favorite characters from the Pixar movies. You're going to see The Incredibles, from Bug's Life, from Finding Nemo, from Ratatouille, Toy Story, and Cars. Uh-huh. You're going to see big, fantastic, beautiful, colorful, gorgeous floats. You're going to see dancers who are dancing, and music by Matthew Gerard, who did all the music from High School Musical. So our music is slamming. It's really dope and fresh. I'm making quotation marks in the air. You're going to see more contemporary choreography than I think you've probably seen in the past at Disney. You're going to see all of the characters from these movies doing all sort of fun, playful things. You're going to see stilts. You're going to see bungees. You're going to see swings. You're going to see bubbles. You're going to have a ball. Trust me.
You weren't kidding about the high energy aspect. Well, now, David, we've talked a little bit about kind of the creative content. Now, tell me what it is, kind of what your responsibilities are.
I along with a producer, work on the production of this. What we do is we're trying to balance the creative and the actual money that comes into this to make this a reality, still have the right creative vision, and still get on the street the way everybody wants to see it.
So you're working with the team that comes up with kind of the creative introduction of like these floats and that, and then actually, how do we get that float? How do we get it made and working and out there?
Yeah, that's exactly right. We start with concept drawings early in the process that kind of sketch out the idea of where we're headed, where we want to be, where we're going. And from there, it goes into development. What can we build with what the money that's available? How do we get this going? And then we have a team together that starts working on the technical director works on building the floats. The costuming team works on getting the costumes. We have the music team getting the music together, and all the teams that fall into line that bring this whole production together.
How many floats are there in this parade?
There are 7 floats in this parade. It gets bigger all the time, actually, and we have lots of little floats here and there, little bicycles and units that are all pushed around. It's great.
And I noticed that some of them seem like they have performers that are kind of in the moving on things and jumping around inside of them.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. We have a few of these floats have some special enhancements, let's say. We have the on the Bugs Life float, we have what we're calling the swingdings that are swinging out over the audience. And we have Flick and Ada on a Russian swing going back and forth. With the Toy Story float, we have acrobats that are swinging on a giant high bar, and they're just with Rex, and it's in Rex's mouth, his eyes looking side to side, just wondering what is going on with these cowboys and cowgirls. We have in the Ratatouille float, we have bungee rats, and in the bungee rats, they're bouncing up and down on spaghetti, basically, is what it looks like. It's a giant sink unit. So inside this giant sink, we have bungees, and the rats are bouncing all over. There's soap bubbles that come down inside the sink. It looks great.
Well, now, obviously, this parade kind of moves through the resort here, but you know, from a show point of view, how long is the portion I'm going to watch, you know, as it kind of comes by?
Yeah, the portion that you're going to see is going to be about 15 minutes, I'd say. 12 or 15 minutes, yeah. And so as you're sitting there, and it comes at you, it's huge, it's fun, it's bright, it's great.
Well, now, and also, Fred, we spoke earlier about kind of the first real parade. And now that you've, you know, worked on it and are getting ready for everybody else to be able to see it, what did you enjoy about it? What did you like about it?
I think the thing that I enjoyed the most was working with the dancers and the talent in the show. The kids here who have worked at Disney for a long time. They've been in the other parades. They're in other shows. The kids are so enthusiastic, and they're so eager to learn new things. They're like hungry to learn more choreography and to learn new skills and new tricks. They work so hard, and it's really easy to feed off of their energy because they're so happy and so into it that it motivates you even more. So that's been something I've really enjoyed. I mean, and then on top of it, who doesn't want to get to choreograph and direct a show that has, like, you know, a Tyrannosaurus Rex with a gigantic high bar and people flipping and twirling and all the other crazy skills? It's so much fun to have those elements at your fingertips to create a picture.
Now, David, tell me a little bit about the kind of the Pixar interaction here.
Yeah, the Pixar team that we work with, they're amazing, and they absolutely love what they do. And you can tell in all the notes that we get back from them about how to make something just a little bit more like what it looks like in the movie. It really is a testament to what they believe in and how just amazing they are at what they do. So we took all of their information to bring you what really, it's like they're stepping right out of the movie.
Tell you, I'm excited already about seeing the Pixar Play Parade. So I want to thank both of you guys for taking the time to chat with us tonight.
Cool, thank you.
Yeah, absolutely. You're welcome. Thanks.
And what did park guests think of the all-new Pixar Play Parade?
I love the Pixar Play Parade because it was so outgoing and fun, and the kids had such a good time. They were dancing, there were bubbles, it was water. I loved it.
It was fabulous. It was all of our favorite movies. The kids were jumping up and down. It was amazing.
I loved it.
Oh, my gosh. I thought it was fantastic for adults and kids. I love the music. I love the dancing, and I love the smiles. Didn't mind getting sprayed. And the bubbles were the end-all be-all. Terrific.
Oh, we thought it was awesome. So cute. The water was fun, and the bubbles were great. It was great.
We loved it. It was really fun, and the kids are excited. It's their first time to Disneyland and California Adventure.
I think it was great. I love cars, so it was really fun to see Lightning McQueen up front showcasing the whole thing, huh?
Yep.
That was cool.
And Tow Mater in the back.
Yep.
I like Tow Mater.
Another new experience at Disney's California Adventure is perfect for preschoolers. It's Playhouse Disney live on stage. Follow along as characters from Disney Channel's hit shows, Mickey Mouse Clubhouse, Little Einsteins, Handy Manny, and others look for help to plan a surprise birthday party for Minnie Mouse. You'll get to join in on the fun as the characters find clues that help them get set for a fun-filled celebration. This production runs daily, so be sure to check the park show schedule for showtimes. Well, that just about does it for this edition. Don't forget, Playhouse Disney live on stage and Pixar Play Parade are in full swing at Disney's California Adventure. So come on out and join the countdown to fun. If you enjoyed the show, please feel free to share it with a friend. And remember, we have both audio and video podcasts available at Disneyland.com /podcast, or in the iTunes podcast directory, where we also always appreciate feedback. While you're there, be sure to check out the newest video podcast. Until next time, I'm your host, Michael Gohagan. Thanks for listening, and we'll talk to you soon.